professional. So, do you want to say your name and what you're up to, sort of general? Just walk in. Yeah.
Oh, I'm Mr. Lauren. Can I say what I'm working in?
Yeah.
I'm working in.
Okay. So, I'm Yanir Bar-Yam. I started out a long time ago working in condensed matter theory and then migrated into complex system science, which I've been doing for over 25 years. And I was thinking about the talk today.
Yanir, would you like to switch on the microphone for the recording?
I think it's on.
Okay.
I switched it, yeah. There's something else I wanted to say, but think about what else should I say by way of introduction. Oh, I'm the founding president of the New England Complex Systems Institute, and the institute is a small independent institute that does a lot of what it does is what I'm doing because it has my research group, but it also coordinates and does courses, coordinates other kinds of activity, does courses in complex system science. Now, really what I thought to do today is not contained in the talk that I'm going to give, in the sense that it's not in the explicit talk, but what I want to do is kind of overlay what I have as a presentation with some discussion of sort of the role of physics in this discussion. And really there are, in some sense, two questions which I want to merge. One question that one might ask is, what is the role of physics in solving real-world problems? And the other one is, what might be the role of physicists in solving real-world problems? Because we know that physicists often go off and do all kinds of other things. And may be successful in whatever, making money on Wall Street or something like that. But that doesn't necessarily make it physics. And for me, I think what I want to do is to talk about something which is really more core to physics than physics of today, which you're all engaged in. And that is that it seems to me that one of the unique contribution of physics is that we both take math and the reality seriously. And that's different from what I see. You know, mathematicians take the math seriously, and biologists and sociologists and so on take the reality, quote unquote, seriously in some sense. But it's really bringing the two together. And by that I mean that it's not necessarily about specific mathematical ideas or specific mathematical tools, which is what distinguishes physics. But actually, and this is what I'm going to kind of show you, that it doesn't always have to be very sophisticated mathematical tools. It's really about making sure that the math that you're using is the right math for what you want to describe in the world. And when we do that, it's quite amazing that we can make a lot of progress in thinking about complex systems. And the fundamental ideas, as far as I'm concerned, of complex system science originate in physics, combined with other things, but originate really in statistical physics of phase transitions, i.e. renormalization group, really the recognition that, well, let me take a step back. The standard view of the world from the point of view of traditional science is calculus and statistics, okay? We learned in statistical physics that calculus and statistics can break down. Okay? You cannot take an average and represent the behavior of a material. You cannot assume smoothness, analyticity, and describe the behavior of a material. How do we overcome that problem? And the answer to overcome that problem is very subtle. We have to take a multi-scale view. We have to view the system on multiple scales. And we have to realize that the necessary variables for describing the problem are not in the average, i.e. we need to add, you know, some measure of fluctuations. And that there is an underlying framework which enables us to figure out what are the relevant variables. You're all familiar with the normalization group, at least a little bit? Or not? Not. Okay. So let me then say a few words about, a few more words about it. So this is just a basic statistical physics. This is the phase diagram of water. So this is pressure and this is temperature. So this is gas, i.e. vapor. This is water and this is ice. And there are subtleties here, but the main point that I want to talk about is that this line ends. What that means is that at high enough pressure and high enough temperature, there is no distinction between water and vapor. You're familiar with that, right? Because you squeeze it together and you go to high temperature and there's no difference between atoms rolling around each other or bouncing. So this line has a discontinuity in density. And if you write the discontinuity in density as a function of the distance along this line, you can write down a simple analytic theory. The analytic theory is written, was described by Landau. It's just basically expansion. It's an expansion of the free energy around that point. And if you write the expansion, you can solve and you find out that the exponent in terms of the variable, which is the difference here, let's call it delta t or whatever, is 1/2. The exponent is 1/2. The experiment is 0.334. Same? No. So what's the problem? The problem is very subtle, and Ken Wilson developed a normalization group and solved the problem. Basically, the problem is not in the math in some sense, the problem is in the variables. The problem is that we're only including average density and we're not including fluctuations. Turns out that the material at this point doesn't know whether to be water or gas, water or vapor, okay? And so it fluctuates, and it fluctuates on all scales up to the macroscopic scale. And that means that you have to write the free energy not just in terms of the density, but in terms of the measure of the fluctuations. Okay, but what we learned from this is much more fundamental in some basic sense. So by the way, if you do it for a magnet, you get exactly the same number. And so the question is, why would vapor, you know, water and a magnet be the same? And the answer is, in some fundamental sense, because the macroscopic description of these things map onto each other mathematically. But what we learned from this is about a concept called universality. I don't know if it's spelled right. Doesn't matter. And the basic idea is that in the large scale limit, in the macroscope, the thermodynamic limit of a system, there are only a few variables that are important. And once we know what those variables are, we can figure out how to solve the problem. But you need to have those variables. And in this case, density is not enough. you need also some measure of fluctuation. Now, why does this relate to complex systems? So complex systems are social systems, biological systems, physical systems, meteorology, things where we have lots of stuff going on. And there are two reasons. One has to do with the structure of the problem. These are what are called order to disorder transitions. And in order to disorder transitions, you go from a case where a system has no dependencies to a system where it has dependencies. Complex systems is really about dependencies. The breakdown of statistics is because correlations are not an adequate description of dependencies in a system. So we have to understand how to describe dependencies. And so this understanding how to describe order to disorder transitions enables us to understand better how to describe dependencies. The other reason is bigger picture. And that is that when people look at a system like the weather, or they look at a system like the social system that we're part of, there are two different strategies that they use. Either they take an average, what's the average height of people, okay? Or they think we have to describe all of the details. What did you have for lunch? How far did you drive to work? All of the details of the system. Why? Because everything matters. It's a complex system. We have to describe everything about it. And what this approach teaches us is that that's not true. Fundamentally, all you have to do is grab the most important variables, the variables that matter at the large scale, in order to describe large scale things, including social systems at the collective scale, i.e. how what people do together. And that idea and the underlying mathematics that Ken Wilson developed in order to characterize it underlies successful work in complex system science. Why? Because if you describe a model, a mathematical model of what everyone is doing all the time, you cannot get the data. Big data, forget big data. It's not big enough. You understand? There's no way to validate a model down to the molecular level, right? So you have to abstract the problem. And the only way to correctly abstract it is to figure out what matters and what doesn't matter. If you figure out what matters, then you've got a valid model. If you don't figure out what matters, then you're always going to be subject to the things that you forgot. And you're always going to have a lot more stuff than you need. Okay? So that's a general strategy, and I'll explain that in a little bit more, a little bit simpler. But everyone's looking at me like I came from the moon, so ask your questions.
Yeah. So the Wilsonian renormalization group involves Boltzmann measures and Hamiltonians.
Yeah.
So does that talk you gave apply in context where it isn't a Hamiltonian, it isn't an equilibrium measure?
Absolutely. So absolutely. So first of all, there have been generalizations. One of the classic work in this regard is KPZ, Kardar-Parisi-Zhang theory, which is about growth of surfaces. But it's a dynamic model. In principle, it's not Hamiltonian. It's a stochastic dynamic thing, which is done using renormalization group methods. But the point is that the ideas are much more fundamental. And that's actually something that I wanted to get to. And let me just do that here. I can do a few. Are there other questions? Let me get to that answer in a few moments. Other questions?
How do you know whether that approach is applicable?
How do you know whether?
It's applicable, this approach is applicable in any given situation.
So at a fundamental level, it has to, oh, I see. So the sense in which it's applicable has to be that the question that you're asking, the tool applies to it, okay? Right. So what kinds of questions does this approach apply to? That's really what the issue is. And the answer is, it's any question that deals with a large-scale behavior system. Okay, so if I want to study, and we've done this, if I want to study sort of organizational effectiveness, all right, is the healthcare system effective at what it does? I'm not sure that question is not answerable within this framework for reasons that I can explain. But if I want to understand global cascades associated with the financial crisis, or if I want to understand global transmission of a disease, or anything that is the biggest behavior of the system, it has to be applicable to that, by definition. And in particular, and this is what I'm going to be talking about, this approach is really relevant to policy. Why is it relevant to policy? Because if policymakers get a policy wrong, it screws things up royally. Okay? And understanding the biggest effect of the policy is the most important thing to figure out. And so that's what we've really been doing. So we've been seeing all kinds of global crises, and we've been saying, hey, you know, we want to help. And we pulled out the tools from our pockets and said, you know, let's line them up on the table. And this tool shows up because it's going to address the biggest thing that's going to go on. All right? Does that help?
So you also need to have the notion of scale, some kind of
correct
locality, I guess.
Correct. And scale is a very tricky thing to define. But we're not necessarily going to define it the same way we used to define it, because we're going to learn that it's actually much more general. But let's define scale in terms of number of elements that are doing the same thing. Okay. Other questions? Okay. Should I go on? So the talk that I have prepared on the slides is a talk for a general audience about this issue, the fact that we have global connectivity in the world, and that makes us vulnerable. Why are we vulnerable? Why are we vulnerable if we have global connectivity? Because anybody's problem becomes everybody's problem, roughly speaking. Okay? So we have financial crises, social unrest, pandemics, terrorism. So this is a talk that I gave about the financial crisis. I don't know if you remember this, some of you. This is Tahrir Square during this Arab Spring. And this is something you probably do remember, which is the Ebola epidemic that's just still happening, really. Okay? Actually, all of these are really still happening. This slide is just to say that complex system science, which uses these tools, and really the tool that I'm talking about here is multi-scale analysis in some sense, we've been able to use it to study many, many different kinds of problems, from cell biology to, you know, ethnic violence, economics, development, so on. And the fact that we can do that really says that these tools are new, powerful, and matter. This is multi-scale stuff. So you're familiar, those of you who are familiar with renormalization group in this sense, are not going to be familiar with a much simpler idea, which is a generalization of it that we are using for this purpose. And all I want to do is take this picture of a mountain and use it to illustrate. So can you see this? It's a little bit washed out. Do we need to reduce the lights? Why don't we turn down the lights a little bit? We have enough light from outside, I think. So this is the picture of a mountain. And as you see, if you look at the picture and you know this, there are pixels that make up the image, right? And we can change the resolution. So I can reduce and reduce the resolution and reduce and reduce the resolution. And this is still the mountain, right? It's just a question of what have we left in our description of the system. So to formalize this, and this is really the fundamental generalization of renormalization group, and it's still in process of development. So the physics here is still, i.e. the mathematical aspects of this still need to be understood better. This is the amount of information as a function of the level of resolution. So you, if we look at the picture, right, the picture has, at a fine resolution, we have a lot of information. And at a very coarse resolution, we have a very small amount of information. And in principle, at least naively, you would expect this curve to decrease monotonically, right? Is that clear? If you take this as a physical measure, and you write this in terms of information theory, then the microscopic information is the entropy up to constants. Okay? So entropy is the amount of information necessary to describe a system at a microscopic scale. That's something you know? Yeah. Okay. But the whole idea here is that scale matters. And if you go back to information theory, you will find out that there is no scale in information. You have one bit. The bit could happen many, many times in a system, and it's just one bit. But it's different if it shows up a lot of times than if it shows up once. And that's what this is about. So this is about large-scale bits that are describing the behavior of the system. So if this is the details, right, this is the microscopics, this is kind of characteristically the large-scale motions that are taking place in the system. And what I've told you that I'm going to focus on, and you can't really see this, is in some sense, the idea of renormalization group is to focus on the tail, the large-scale tail of the distribution of bits. Is that clear? Now, in formal theory, what's done is to take the thermodynamic limit. Now, I don't want to do that, because in the thermodynamic limit, nothing matters in complex systems. Well, I shouldn't say that entirely, but yeah, you'll end up with gravity in the largest scale. So what do we do? And the answer is, what we have to do is to understand that fundamentally what we're looking for are the largest scale behaviors of the system self-consistently. In other words, we need to make sure that we capture all of them and ignore the stuff down here. Okay? Questions? Now I'm going to dive into application. Okay. Let me just say one more thing, a couple more things, sort of basics. And we'll dive into that, but I'm not going to do any more of the theory. This is standard physics, i.e. not statistical physics. Standard physics, way back when, what it said is that we can do thermodynamics for the details, i.e. statistics. And we can do mechanics for the collective behaviors, okay? And that works when there's a certain property that holds, which is called, which I don't know that anyone else has called it this, but I call it separation of scales, right? So you have a macro scale behavior that you describe explicitly and a micro scale behavior that you average over. Is that clear? When you have this swarm of birds or flock of birds, neither of those descriptions are really useful. Okay? You don't care about what the average is doing, unless there are certain cases where you do. And you surely don't care most of the time about what each individual bird is doing. What you need is to capture the different scales of behavior of the system, and that's really the crux of it. Okay? So this is what we're after. There's one other kind of brief introduction here. How many of you are familiar with, I mean, I don't want to assume too much, fat tail distributions? Familiar with fat tail distributions a little bit? Okay, so let me say a few words about that. So when you assume independence, right, the central limit theorem tells you that you get normal distributions. Okay, when the central limit theorem doesn't apply, and I'll show you what I show people in order to make this clear, you end up with fat tail distributions, which are, okay, you end up with fat tail distributions which have long tails. So the whole idea is a distribution of events, right? Different observations of the system. So a normal event is within the, you know, basically this range, right? And an extreme event is outside of that range. So the way a normal event arises from the central limit theorem is because you have independent steps that you're taking that make up, there may be a few more here, kind of random steps, that make up this thing. And the fact that these are independent steps makes this a normal distribution. If they are dependent on each other, say it the other way, in order to get an extreme event, these have to be somewhat dependent on each other. So let me describe a world in which we live with a normal distribution. The normal distribution is characteristic of a world where events are basically all the same. If you've seen 100 events, you've seen them all. Okay? When you have a long-tail distribution, or a fat-tail distribution, or wide-tail, there are all kinds of names for it. Typically, often, they're power laws, right? So it's not just that they're generally fat-tails, but that they have a particular form. Then that's not true. You may have seen a lot of stuff, but the next event may be quite different from what you've seen in the past. And that's really important for policy people, for policymakers, because they judge the future experientially. So for example, when the Ebola crisis happened now, people don't know how to evaluate what's happening, because they have experience about Ebola from the past. So they say, well, we'll do what we did before and it will work now. A lot of people that talk about the fact, for example, that Ebola only killed a few people in the United States, and look, you know, traffic accidents kill a lot more people. So why should we be worried about Ebola? We should be worried about traffic accidents, or name your other big killer. Without understanding that something that grows exponentially is very different from something that's been steady state for a long time. Okay? So they don't have the tools for thinking about anomalies. And we have to do that when we have these kind of dependencies. So, but going back to this idea, what we want to do in complex system science is we want to understand dependencies and collective behaviors. And that is exactly what gives rise to extreme events. So extreme events and collective behaviors are sort of the same thing. So now that brings us to what I'm going to talk about. And again, I'm going to go through this presentation, ask questions, whatever you'd like. This is Tahrir Square. Okay? This was the Arab Spring, 2010. Do you remember it? So I want to start, and this is how I motivate the work that we're doing. I say, why? Why did this happen? And the answer that most people will give you is these bad dictators were responsible for this. That's not a very good answer, because 20, 30, 40 years of these dictators happened before all of a sudden the Arab Spring. Not a very good answer. Here's a good answer. This black curve is an index of food prices, okay, put out by the UN. It's basic foods, so it's appropriate for people that are earning a dollar a day, right? Earning is maybe, you know, to have a dollar a day to spend on everything. These red dashed lines are food riots. This is the Arab Spring. Clear? Pretty clear. The blue dashed line is the date that we submitted a report to the government saying high food prices, social unrest, political instability. That was 4 days before Mohamed Bouazizi started things in Tunisia. Now, I don't think that we need this curve to show us that food is related to social unrest. In fact, that's why I looked this up. I saw that the food prices went up and I said, oh, we're in trouble. We better look at what's happening in social unrest. Because we have a long history of Russian Revolution, French Revolution, other revolutions. I don't know how much history you know, but there's a lot of food-related social unrest. We don't need that. But what this does show us is that global food prices, are related to social unrest in many parts of the world. That would not have been true 50 years ago. There is a global food supply system that is playing a key role in what's going on in unrest in these places. There's another thing that I don't know that other people would trigger on, but for a physicist, at least, it looks like there's a kind of phase transition here, right? Below that value, there isn't much. And above that value, there's a lot of social unrest. Is that clear? So there's a kind of level of desperation, at least in these poor countries, where people, you know, can't feed their families and they go out into the streets and riot, which makes some sense. So this is a first step.
So can I ask?
Yeah.
So if the food prices are global, why didn't we see a global rise?
Well, I mean, the world is not homogeneous in terms of its social and economic structures. So one can easily expect that sort of more vulnerable populations and less places where people have less alternatives to the basic necessities are going to be more strongly affected. So this clearly has to do with, you know, socioeconomic conditions, not just the price. So yeah, we didn't solve all that.
And cultural connections as well. I mean, the
absolutely
spring took place in the Arab world because of the connection between these countries.
Absolutely.
Linguistic connection.
There's another actually reason, which is not clear from this, but those countries are wheat-eating countries.
Yeah.
And the impact on prices is a little bit different. This is just the overall index. The impact on wheat-eating versus corn-eating versus rice-eating was different. In particular, rice-eating countries were not affected. They were affected by this peak, but they were not affected by that peak. So there's another layer. Again, going down in terms of levels of detail, there's another level of detail.
So would it be fair to say that the prediction could have been there is going to be social unrest, but we couldn't tell you where?
That's exactly what we said. I mean, we just said, you know, hey, we're in trouble, bottom line. We didn't do more than that. And surely I would not have claimed to have predicted any particular place. I mean, that's the level of precision of the analysis.
So another question. Is it going to matter whether these places are, say, net importers or exporters of food and the strength of their currency relative to, say,
yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. I mean, these are all essentially all food importers, right? Who's the food exporter? We are. A few other countries. In fact, here's the figure. This is the global wheat supply system. So with red are importers and blue are exporters. Now, in principle, of course, the fact that the US is a wheat exporter doesn't mean that poor people in this country are not affected by food prices. They are not wheat exporters.
And And what were the numbers in the previous graph in parentheses?
Fatalities. Sorry, we picked only the ones that had fatalities, so this is just giving the number.
So many of those Arab countries also are oil exporters, right?
Correct.
I just read this morning in Syria, for example, has experienced depletion. Do you know about those other?
Yeah, and I think that the point of this, I mean, the question is a good one, but the point is that, remember, here's the issue. There's a lot of details that are going on, but what we want to do is just grab the first order behavior and then go to the next level. Okay? So this is the wheat economy, if you will. Let's look at food prices for a moment. Can you see over this? Yeah. You notice something? So there's clearly something different going on over here. This is the period of time that I've showed you before. This is going back to 1980. So this requires an explanation, right? So what is the explanation? And here is where there's a lot of discussion in the literature about different things like a drought in Australia, change in diet in China, right, in India, because they're developing. So as you shift to meat diet, it consumes a lot more grain. There's corn to ethanol conversion in the US. There's a mandated their biofuels program in the US. This is a really interesting one. So this is the question as to whether markets can be out of equilibrium. I don't know how much you've followed with economic markets, but economic markets are described in traditional economics by supply and demand equilibrium, right? And there's a basic question and very big denial that these markets can be out of equilibrium, i.e. prices can be different from the equilibrium price. And this is debated in the literature, and I'm going to talk about this in a moment. Then there's currency conversion rates, and oil prices as causing food prices. If oil prices go up, then that increases the cost of making food. I'm going to talk about these four. This is meat in China. Just do it. So let me just say something for a moment. If you go to the economics literature, what they will do is they will take time series associated with each of these things and they will correlate it with the prices. They will absolutely correlate it with the prices and then make an argument that says this may be part of the effect. Let me show you what we did. Okay? This is global change in grain production from 1 year to the next. This is the change in Australian grain production from 1 year to the next. If Australian grain production were to cause a major price change, then global grain production would cause a much larger price change, right? So this has got to be tiny if you write a mathematical equation that describes it. So I'm just going to throw this one out. And let me just say that that's non-trivial in terms of the literature. Next. Here's the demand in China. So it turns out that China during this period was a net grain exporter. And the amount of grain they were exporting went down by 5 million metric tons. That's a lot of grain. Okay? Went down meaning they had larger demand, which would drive prices up, right? But this red line is the effect of ethanol. Ethanol in the US. It's an order of magnitude larger. There is a subtlety here when you make, ethanol is just fermented, right? Ethanol is alcohol, right? So it's just fermented sugar. So they take corn and they turn it into ethanol and stick it into cars. You have it here too, right? In gasoline, I'm quite sure. In the US also. So when they distill it, when they do the distillation, there's a byproduct which goes back to feed. So you could argue that this is the net impact. This is still an order of magnitude larger than that. So we should just throw this out. I don't care if it correlates with what's going on. Right? Is that clear? Here's exchange rates. So again, there are a bunch of economics articles that say, look, we got a correlation. It turns out the sign is wrong. US is a net grain exporter. So prices, if we go through the math, this should go down instead of up, if that's going up. So this just doesn't make any sense. So we can throw it out, but you notice that the correlation goes away afterwards also. So that's gone. This is oil dependency. So just to, I can go over this quickly. This is the mortgage market crash. This is the stock market crash. This is a peak that includes food, wheat, corn, oil, silver. So we're going to get to this in a moment, but why would all commodities peak at the same time? Why does the supply and demand work the same way for corn, for oil, and for silver? It actually doesn't make any sense. And why would they peak after the crash of the stock market? A recession is coming. Prices go down. That's exactly right. And in fact, looking at this figure, we said, this is movement of money. But remember, that's not supply and demand. And so fundamental economics doesn't work. And if fundamental economics doesn't work, economists cannot analyze this. And if economists can't analyze this, in we go, right? This is an opportunity for us to figure out an important thing that's going on in the world, which they can't do. Well, let me pull out, remember, the reason for this discussion was oil and wheat. So, but if you look at wheat and oil, you see that the wheat peak happens before the oil peak. So there are other ways to make this argument, but let me just say this kind of eliminates oil as a possible cause of food prices. So we're just going to throw out oil as well. So what I've done, instead of taking, you know, a dozen or whatever it was, you know, all of these things and put them into a correlation calculation, I've taken four of them and I'm just throwing them out. What I'm left with is just two things. One is a supply and demand. So the supply and demand factor, the only one that's left on the table is ethanol. And the other one is the effect of speculation. Speculation is activities on the market that are driving the prices having nothing to do with fundamental value. How does this work? This works by what is called trend following. If prices go up, do you buy or do you sell? Sell. If prices are above equilibrium, you sell and the price goes down. If prices are below equilibrium, you buy and the price goes up. That's the old style economics. But what happens if prices go up today? What happens is that people expect that prices will continue to go up and they buy. What happens if they buy? It drives prices up even more. So there's papers in 1989 and 1990 by famous people that show that in economics they destabilize the equilibrium. If you do trend following, it makes the equilibrium. You take the derivative, right? You take the stability analysis and you show that the eigenvector is eigenvalue is negative, right? So you go away from equilibrium. But no one ever described what the dynamics are like. So we did. So there are two things that we put in. We put in trend following and market shifting. And believe me, the mathematics here are really simple. So this is an updated, it's a dynamic equation that updates prices from one time to the next time. The first two terms are the demand due to ethanol plus a term which describes how much people sell if the price is above and buy if the price is below. That creates an exponential decay. So this would be, by itself, would create an exponential decay towards the equilibrium price. This is the effect of trend following, which you can see is just if the price goes up, you buy, driving the price up more. And all this does is it tells you that you, if a different market, the stock market goes up, or the bond market goes up, those are the only two that are relevant, then people will move their money to the stock or to the bond market, right? If another market goes up, they shift their money out of the commodities market. The number of parameters here is really small. There are two primary parameters. This is empirical, basically, and And these are small. One of these is totally irrelevant, really, the bond market. And the stock market parameter is small. So two parameters plus. Let's call it three parameters. This is the data, the blue, and this is the theory. Pretty good. So what this is the result of is exactly the prescription that we gave over here, which is we're just going to throw everything out unless it's the biggest thing, okay? We're going to make sure that we got all the biggest things. We'll do, it's basically a Taylor expansion around big, right? I mean, it's an asymptotic expansion. And we get the result. Now, we had to get the right result. But you claim that and people think that you're arrogant. But the reason why we had to get the result is that we did the physics right. We got the right parameters. And so we had to get the right answer. And that's what we get. Now this also explains to us incredibly what's going on. This is the effect of ethanol. Now if you look at it, this is a policy, right? This is a government mandate that has caused doubling of food prices. If you don't see here, this is about 100, right? We're starting from 100 here. And this is 200. So by now, we're talking about a doubling of food prices just because of this government mandate to take corn. It's about 45% of US corn is being turned into ethanol. We're burning it in gasoline. It has no impact on the energy system. It's actually amount of energy in to energy out is 1-to-1, so it's really stupid in that regard. It is, people thought it would be good for environment because it's renewable. It has no benefit for environmental reasons. All it has really done is increase global food prices. And enrich corn farmers. Yeah. The speculative piece is this piece. Now, speculators, it's a zero-sum game in some sense. Not quite, but almost a zero-sum game because there are people that gain and lose. But there's what's called the last fool theory, right? Someone's left holding the bag and you don't think it's going to be you. So this is a speculative bubble. What happens here is that, well, so this starts when the mortgage market crashes. People move their money, as you said, into the commodities market, which is a small market. The price goes up. They drive it up, 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 up. Eventually gets high enough so that these other guys, the ones that are selling high and buying low, right, dominate the dynamics, and it starts going down. And this is actually just an oscillator. So this is an oscillator superimposed. It's either a damped or amplifying oscillator. It can either grow, the oscillations can grow or shrink. In this case, it's in the parameter domain of growing oscillations. Doesn't matter. But the fit is good, but this is out of equilibrium. Now, here's the trick. If this is out of equilibrium, and this is the price difference, what this means is supply and demand don't match. Remember, supply and demand don't match when prices are out of equilibrium. So if prices are high, people can't buy it. But people are producing it, right? The producers are really happily away producing more and more corn because the price is high. So where does the corn go? And the answer is it has to go to inventories. So there is an economist, his name is Paul Krugman, who happened to receive the Nobel Prize a number of years ago, and he writes for the New York Times a lot, if you haven't seen his articles. He said, we don't see accumulation in inventories, so there can't be out of equilibrium. There's one problem. And look, he's not an expert in agricultural commodities. But the problem is that these are futures markets. The way futures markets work is you buy not for delivery today, but for delivery 6 to 12 months out if you're a buyer. So you look 6 to 12 months out. Do you see this green background? This is the increase in inventory. So this is the grain. It shows up 6 to 12 months later in inventories. And this is enough grain to feed 2/3 of a billion people. Remember all those people who were rioting, who couldn't buy food? So this is a fundamental breakdown of the economic system. It really is. Supply doesn't equal demand, and we're not using the resources that are available. People are going hungry, and the grain is accumulating in inventory. This is the real world. So that's kind of what I had to say about it. There's a little bit extra here. So if you looked at how food prices went afterwards, I thought there was one more. Here it is. So this is with 15 months extra data, just to show you that. So in a traditional scientific analysis, you would do in-sample and out-of-sample, right? This is the data we fit, and this is other data. And in this case, we just waited another 15 months, and we took the data. You notice that the data went down. It was going up, then it went down. The theory also went down. That's an incredible, right, agreement. The red is with slightly tweaked parameters, and the green is without tweaking the parameters, which is basically the same.
Is there a scale that knows about 240? So the turnaround
point? No. This is a balance between a term that promotes oscillations and a term that has exponential decay. There's a term that drives you away from equilibrium, right? That's the speculated term. And there's a term that drives you toward.
So there must be a term in the equation that has a scale to determine when the turnaround point arrives.
Correct. And it's a balance between these two parameters. There's a scale of amplitude and there's a scale of time. And those are transformations of the two parameters that you have in the model. There's only two parameters as far as that's concerned.
So is there one of these parameters that has dimensions of index price?
Yeah, I mean, we can go back and look at it.
Just to see where that threshold will come from.
So this and this are the two parameters. So you see there's a one here, so it gives it scale. This is not... Not without scale, I guess. I mean, it's
pretty much dimensionless.
Yeah. To remember how the dimensions work here.
It's about understanding what sets a maximal value for p.
Correct. Eventually, there are two different, right? But you could talk about it as a fractional deviation from the equilibrium price. So fractional deviation is dimensional.
So it means that the ethanol shock is the term that fixes the...
No, the ethanol shock just does this.
It fixes the baseline for P.
That's right. It just fixes the baseline. That's right. It just sets the magnitude. Correct. So anyway, so we could look at the dimensionality of this thing, but I think I'm going forward instead of back here. In any case, this... You can stare at this equation and figure out, but the way this is written, these are dimensionless because p's can be proportional, basically, to the base. Yeah?
It looks like the ethanol usage of grain is still increasing. Is that true?
So this year, basically, last year and this year, it kind of ran into what's called the blend wall, which is when 10% of all gasoline actually in the U.S. has ethanol, is ethanol.
It should plateau.
So it should plateau. In principle, the law, by the way, it should keep going up. And there's a big fight at the EPA, with the EPA and the industries that are at stake here. And in fact, just 2 days ago, the EPA postponed a decision because they're still fighting about it. Okay, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, because it was kind of framed as a green thing, the EPA is the agency that's supposed to be dealing with this. And they were basically sold to the ethanol industry. The petroleum industry, i.e. Gasoline people, were given a subsidy. And that subsidy was eliminated, so now they've shifted sides. This is the way it goes, right? This is this policy side. So going back here, let me just say that after it went down, I don't want to do too much here. After it went down, it went back up, and it kind of stayed steady at exactly this threshold, 210, for about 18 months to 2 years. During that period of time, so imagine you're at the boiling point, right? So at the boiling point, you don't have a lot of bubbling, but anything local that happens is going to drive things into revolution. Kind of here. So you can think about it as a social temperature being high. Oh, this is just press coverage for our work. But this is what I wanted to show you. And there's really been a lot of social unrest around the world. I mean, I don't know if you follow the news and so on, but there's been a huge amount of social unrest, and it's basically linked to you can look at individual cases and ask what proportion of what's going on is due to food, and it shows up in a lot of places. It's not, doesn't have to be dominant in any particular place. Our work got a lot of press coverage. There's a particular group in Germany called Food Watch Germany. They put out a report called The Hunger Makers, where they cite our work quite strongly, saying that the financial institutions are complicit in world hunger. And they mounted a campaign with photographs of the CEO of Deutsche Bank opposite hungry children in Africa. As a result, a whole bunch of European, major European banks pulled out of agricultural commodity trading. This January, almost a year ago now, the European Union Commission adopted a rule on agricultural trading that that said it will contribute to orderly pricing and prevent market abuse, thus curbing speculation on commodities and the disastrous impacts it can have on the world's poorest population. So that's our work. So we've had actual impact on policy. It's not the only time, but this is one of the places. Okay.
Is it fair to say that this is the consequence of your work?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Are there some details about what kind of policy is planned to be used? And
yeah.
Have you tried to estimate whether it will be like an ethanol policy yeah. and screw things up?
Yeah, exactly. So to say that the policy is our effect doesn't necessarily mean that it's actually fixed anything. Yeah. So part of the problem is it's really the U.S. commodity markets that are the major market commodity markets in this context, right? It's the Chicago Board of Trade. In the U.S., the regulatory agency is the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And they've actually been trying to, so what happened is, it's a little bit more subtle. The commodity markets used to be regulated. There were what are called trading limits. There were amounts of limits that you could own of a particular thing. And that limited the kinds of trading that could go on. They were deregulated in 1989. 2000, just at that time. Now that kind of sort of opened the door, and then when the mortgage market crashed, then the money flowed in. But what set that up is that it was possible to set up what are called index funds that enabled anybody to invest in commodities, which otherwise was a fairly limited domain of investing. There was earlier, so it's not just food that has been subject to speculation, but oil prices, energy prices. Canada benefited from it quite a bit, right? The energy prices, as well as the food prices. It's also a food export. In any case, accusations that oil prices were due to speculation were kind of rampant. And our analysis shows that that's true. We haven't published it, but it's quite clear. Where were we going? I asked about
this particular policy and whether...
Okay. So the point is the following. The CFTC, which regulates things in the U.S., tried to re-regulate after, you know, a number of things that happened. I don't think we can claim credit for that. Never mind. So we can't claim credit for it. They tried to re-regulate it. They were sued by the trading industry. A judge blocked their new regulation, and the organization has been defunded by Congress. The Republicans basically prevented the CFTC from operating. Everything's kind of in limbo. This is kind of what's going on. So there are laws in Congress to repeal the ethanol mandate. U.S. Congress is paralyzed. And the CFTC has been trying to re-regulate commodities and is paralyzed. So the system is screwed up. I don't have to tell you that. That's the way things are right now. So let me actually ask you, I mean, we're kind of at the end of the time. And I did only one of the three topics. I can just tell you what the other topics are, and if you want, I don't mind going doing one of them or whatever you'd like. The second topic I was planning to cover is what happened with deregulation of the stock market and our analysis of why that happened and showing why the crazy people at the regulatory agency didn't figure it out. The other is Ebola. So I could do Ebola in about 5 minutes if you'd like. The other one takes probably about 10, 15. So what would you like? I mean, we don't have to do anything as far as I'm concerned. I could just sum up.
I would say we could, I would be interested in hearing more, but then if people have other things to do, they should probably feel free to go.
Yeah.
If they are interested in more, they can say.
Sure. So let me just sum up then, and I would say the following. There are really two sides. I mean, one could argue that there are problems. We actually, as I think I've shown, we have the tools to solve them. I mean, the math that we did here is simple nonlinear dynamics, or simple dynamics, if you will. It's not really about the mathematical equation that eventually results, which is important. It's about the understanding of figuring out what's important and unimportant that eventually informs it. And people don't get this. I mean, the point is that, you know, I write down this equation and it fits, right? And so when people look at it, they say, oh, you had a hypothesis and it worked. You know, just like, you know, you guessed it. There's no way to guess things like this. So you have to have a fundamental perspective in order to be able to get it right. And we've done this over and over again in ethnic violence, in stock market, in panic behavior, in the Ebola context, and so on. It just happens over and over and over again. And most people, of course, don't see this because each of the works that we've done is in a different domain. And so everyone only sees what we do in their domain. And so there's one model that we happen to write down which fits the data. But the fact that we do this everywhere is because we really understand what you need to write down in order to get it right. But writing down the right equation doesn't mean the right equation is some fancy field theory. It's just whatever happens to be the right equation for that problem. And that's what we've been doing. And that's the science side. On the other side, the world is in trouble. I mean, the reason why we're doing this is because we're vulnerable. Well, first of all, because there are problems and we can help. That's enough. But beyond that, there is no doubt that the world is at risk. And it is very clear that policymakers have not got a clue. And if they keep doing what they're doing, they're going to keep causing, you know, global problems. You know, they make an ethanol policy or they deregulate the markets and the markets go haywire and you know, there's riots and revolutions around the world. Or if we talk about Ebola, there's a pandemic of Ebola or other things that are around the corner. They don't understand the consequences of what they're doing. And science, our science, physics, understanding complex systems is really can make a difference. So thanks. So anyone wants to leave? Which should I do? Should I do Ebola next? Do you want to hear stock markets? You know, raise your hand. Stock markets. Who wants to hear stock market? You people? Who wants to hear Ebola? Okay. Should I do just both? I mean, I'll try to do them fairly quickly so we don't take the rest of your day. But here. Okay. This is the necessary hockey stick. I have to remember that. In Canada, you use a hockey stick for a doorstop.
It's the pointer.
It's the pointer, I see. Yeah. So let me talk about stock market for a few minutes. Just read this. This is a text of the Securities and Exchange Commission just before, as they deregulated the stock market in June of 2007. Now, you may not remember dates, but June of 2007 was really just as the financial crisis was kicking off. So if you read this, you see they were really happy. Everything's going great. It's all nice. Let me just fast forward here. This is what was a year later. The same people This is what they said. Does that sound different? It's a lot different. Okay. So this is in the middle of the financial crisis, and they make an emergency intervention in order to stop what's going on. What they did, the rule that they eliminated, so let me just show you. There's a direct causal link. They eliminated the rule actually July 6th of 2007, exactly 1 month later, at the beginning of August. The interbank lending rate went haywire. Now, why would that happen? Well, what triggered the interbank lending rate to go haywire was a bank pulled in loans from someone that was an investor claiming that their risks were too high. Now, it turns out that the repeal of the rule that they did, there's no doubt about this, increases volatility. So it increases the fluctuations on the markets. And if you know to measure risk, right, risk increases with volatility. So the volatility goes up, has nothing to do with prices, well, it has to do with prices, but it surely has to do with volatility. If the volatility goes up, the risk goes up. So if the risk goes up, you say, oh, I'll pull in your loans, and that triggers the cascade of the financial crisis. Now, clearly, they were vulnerable, right? This is kind of the spark that lit things off, but there's a direct connection. Now, the rule that they repealed was a rule that did something very specific. So let me explain it. It is totally legal to borrow shares of a company, borrow ownership, and sell it on the market. And then later, you buy it back and return it to the person you borrowed it from. Now, notice that if you borrow it and sell it, you benefit if the price goes down. So you want the price to go down. If the price goes up, you lose. Is that clear? So the chronology was that it was implemented in 1938. So it's around for a long time. I don't know if you want the story. It was implemented by Joseph Kennedy. You know who Kennedy, the Kennedy family is, right? In Massachusetts, they're very important in particular. So the reason why he was put into office as the first chairman of the SEC, Roosevelt was asked, he says, it takes a crook to catch one. Because the Kennedy family made a lot of money on market manipulation before the Great Depression. Okay, so let me show you what they did. The SEC did a pilot study. They did a real-world experiment. They repealed this rule. Oh, I didn't tell you what the rule is. The rule is that if you sell borrowed shares, you cannot sell them on the downward-moving price. So why would you not want to, why would they want to stop you from selling it on the downward moving price? Because if the price is moving downward, you sell and sell and sell and sell, you can drive the price down, right? And you can create a panic. You can do that by accident, or you can do it intentionally. So one is manipulation, that's the intentional part. The unintentional is just a herd behavior, okay? So they require you to put the offer above, so you can only sell it as the price is going up. So it's called an uptick, the uptick rule, because you sell on upward moving prices. Now, this is what they did. They repealed the rule on 1/3 of the stocks on the stock market. So you have a direct comparison of with rule, without rule. Now, that's not a very good comparison because it happens in the same a certain kind of market. This was an upward moving market. But what I want to do is show you the analysis that they did. Okay, what they were doing is they're asking the following question. Is there a difference between the stocks that are regulated and the stocks that are unregulated? So the black line is the average difference between the regulated and unregulated stocks in terms of their returns, right? How well the stock did. And what we see is that the unregulated stocks did less well in a six-month period, which is what the study was done, by about 2.5%, 2.4% or something like that. Now, here is how well stocks have done on average over 50 years. 3.4%, something like that. Okay? So if this is the average difference, less, what this would do if it was here, then it would eliminate all the gains of stocks. Is that an important effect? Yes, it's clearly an important effect. They didn't talk about that in their study. They published a study. You can look at the study. What they did is they talked about the tail of the distribution over here. So this is the statistical distribution of the outcomes. So this is the average, and the average is uncertain. So it could be down here, or it could be up here. But the question that they asked statistically is, do we know that it's negative? For sure. What's the statistical measure of certainty? Is that there isn't more than 5% of the tail of the distribution that's up here. Right? That's the statistical test. So they said, look at this solid line. There's more than 5% chance that it's up there, so this isn't statistically significant, so we're done, we'll just repeal the rule, everything's fine. Does that make sense? It makes no sense. Right? If you go to the Wikipedia page on statistics, it says, don't make the mistake of confusing statistical significance with significance. This is clearly a significant result. Statistical significance is not the right question. But this is what they reported in their study. So if I told you that the whole financial crisis was due to this mistake, would you believe me? And the answer is, this is the evidence. Okay? They repealed the rule. Now, we actually went in and we looked at the way they did the statistics, and the details are not important here, but we just a little bit improved the way they did the analysis, and now it's statistically significant. Okay, so it's totally crazy, right, to do this additional analysis, because it isn't what matters. But if you did the statistical analysis a little bit better, you would find out that it is statistically significant. Is it clear what's going on here? Ask questions if it's not clear. Yeah?
Why is there doubt about the average for the stocks that were still regulated, but apparently the stocks that were regulated is just
So this is the difference. Now, what you do is you have two populations,
okay,
and you have one population, you can take the average, and the other population, you can take the average, and you can calculate the difference. Or you. What?
That gives you a number.
That gives you a number.
You get the probability.
And now you have a probability distribution of that number. And the point is that the probability of that distribution of that number, which is negative, right, can be larger.
I'm missing the point where you get the probability distribution.
Oh, probability distribution. Because what you do is you interpret each of the individual stocks as a sample from a distribution. Okay, and now you take an average, assuming that it's sampled from an actual distribution, and then you can do the statistics on that distribution. Which is clearly a whole bunch of assumptions, but that's how they do statistics. Is that fair? Good. Okay, so here, a year later, everyone's panicking, and they, so let me just say just a few more things. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the flash crash. The flash crash was 15 minutes and the stock market went boom, okay, and then recovered. Individual stocks, this one is Accenture. It went down by 98%. So it was worth $100 and went down to $2 and then recovered to $100, okay? And what they did actually, the stock markets canceled trades on the markets because they said this is unreasonable. They canceled trades that were more than 60% off of the regular price. Why not 40% or 30% or 20% or even 10%? What's a reasonable way to be out of equilibrium? You understand it's clear that this is not a functioning market. So I have to explain to you why this happens, and then you'll see why the uptick rule is really relevant here. So this is the way a market works. Basically, people are trading, right? But the way it works is that you want to sell. You decide at what price you want to sell, and you put it on the table with a label, I want to sell it for this price. That sits over here. And someone else comes and says, I want to buy it. So you say, I want to buy it. And you put your price on the table. Now, if those prices are the same, then you exchange. But otherwise, there are prices that are below and prices that are above. And if someone comes and says, I want to buy regardless, I want to sell regardless, it eats up some of the orders that are on the table. Now, what happens if someone says, I want to sell a lot? Well, it eats up all the orders on the table, and then there's nothing left here. Now, why is there nothing here? Surely there would be people who would be willing to buy it down here. You would buy Accenture for $2 a share, right? Surely. Why? Because no one's expecting it to go down that low. So there are no offers down here. So once you get beyond this range, you can go down forever, and there's no bound to the price decline. Now, what's the solution to this? Well, somebody might say, well, the solution is why doesn't everybody put their orders in regardless? But if you think psychologically, that doesn't really make sense. So what the SEC actually did is they said, we're not going to allow any orders down here to prevent any executions if it happens that the price goes haywire, which is kind of crazy. In any case, this is still going on, okay? So it's not that it happens market-wide, but there are individual stocks that go boom and then recover on a daily basis. This happens all the time. So here's an additional piece of the story. We actually ended up getting data that's not public data about borrowed shares. And we looked historically, and this borrowed shares has this funny behavior, which is someone borrowed $5 billion of shares and then returned them 5 days later. Now, why do I say returned them? I mean, anyone could have returned them, right? But no, exactly 5 days later, all the shares were returned. This is way more than the outstanding shares. So, so I told you that you can do this by accident or you can do this on purpose. This is the signature of a bear raid. Someone came, borrowed shares, dumped them on the market, drove the price down, bought them back, made a lot of money, okay? And this is market manipulation. So this is a really signature of market manipulation. And this happened just in the sort of toward the end of 2007 when this market was falling apart and clearly at a critical time in the market. So here's the upshot. We hadn't done all of this analysis. Going back to relevant things, we didn't actually have to do any analysis in order to figure this out. It was obvious when the market went haywire in the fall of 2007 that the market was not behaving in a reasonable way. Markets just don't behave that way. So all we had to do was look for a reason. And as soon as we saw that the uptick rule was repealed, it was clear that that was a reason. Later, we did all this analysis in order to back up what we already knew. But what I did is, in the fall of 2008, I went to a congressman who happened to be my congressman who was head of the Financial Services Committee in the House of Representatives. His name is Barney Frank. And I had known him from earlier work. I send him a nice report. He read the report. I walked into his office. It took just one sentence. He said, so I need to go to the SEC chairman and tell him that we're going to reinstate the uptick rule. The first meeting that they had was in March 10th of 2009 because it was a new SEC chairman, so this was the first meeting that he could arrange with her. They walked out of the office and said she said they're going to look into reinstating the uptick rule. He said they're going to reinstate the uptick rule, whatever the details. That was the bottom of the market. Why? The reason is they hadn't changed any rule yet. But remember, the people who are trading on the market, if they hear that the uptick rule is going to be reinstated, then it's going to change the dynamics of the market. The people who are selling borrowed shares are not going to believe that they can control the market. So they started pulling out of the market. And there was so much, the market was basically hugely sold on borrowed shares. It just jumped and kept going up. So when I give this talk some places, I say, I'll take a commission. Okay. So we are responsible for the bottom of the market. Yes?
I have a question about the flash crashes.
Yep.
You're saying that people have these standing orders that if the price drops so low, the auto automatically buys. If it goes up, it automatically sells, right?
I'm sorry.
You had that chart.
Figure.
And you said if someone buys, it drives the price down. I thought it was the opposite.
Sells. Okay. I used the word wrong word. If someone sells, then they eat up these buy orders.
And those orders usually they normalize the market. It stops that behavior of
right. If there's enough time,
yeah, it
then it will shift the price downward, and other people will reestablish orders here.
Okay, but if it overcomes that barrier, then
but
suddenly
if it,
people
that's
are
right. If it goes
selling,
too
selling,
fast,
selling. Okay.
If it goes too fast, then it doesn't happen. So notice that. Remember the uptick rule? So the uptick rule is you have to put the sell orders above the price if they're borrowed shares.
Right. Okay.
So you see how that prevents you from doing exactly this.
Okay. So you can't have a sell order below the price.
Correct.
Okay.
Exactly right.
That's only for borrowed shares.
Only for borrowed shares.
Otherwise you can put it
Correct.
Below.
Correct. So if you own the company, you can sell. But the whole point of borrowed shares is that if you own shares, you want the price to go up. You don't want the price to go down. So typically, if you sell borrowed share, if you sell your own shares, you actually sell them slowly. If you have a lot of them, they sell them slowly in order to prevent shifting the price. So it's the ones that will benefit from it going down that are going to sell it fast. Yeah.
So, but it looked like the market bottomed out well before 2000. In this
curve?
This one, yeah.
No.
The
2009.
Crash, yeah, the flash crash.
Oh, the flash crash is later. So what happened historically is the following. The SEC on that day said they were going to reinstate the uptick rule. They took almost 2 years before they instated any rule. And the only rule that they instated was I spoke at the SEC the day before they implemented the new rule. And the news stories all say that they consulted with the hedge funds. The news stories don't say they consulted with me, of course. But they really went according to the hedge funds that were telling them, no, don't regulate the market. So they what they did is instead of creating the uptick rule the way it was, they created a rule which is called the modified uptick rule or whatever, which is only on a circuit breaker. If a stock goes down by 10% in a day, then you have the uptick. Okay.
And then how much do flash crashes have to do with like algorithmic trading?
Yeah, I mean, sure. But the point is that even the algorithmic trading, if they're doing short selling, they would be subject to the uptick rule.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the point is that if you look at the SEC analysis, they're hiding the short selling. They talk about, they use a different terminology in order to hide the fact. There's other work that we've done. There's a paper that we've done doing game theory analysis of regulatory capture. Regulatory capture is when the regulators are supposed to regulate an industry, but the industry controls the regulators, basically. This is really clearly what's happening with the SEC. So we can talk science until we're blue. As long as the companies are controlling what's going on there, it's very hard. But the trick is to make the consequences of their actions so transparent that they have to do something about it, which is difficult, but that's the objective. Is it clear?
Yeah.
Okay. But does that answer your question? I mean, you're asking how did it happen that the flash crash happened later, and the answer is they never instated the rule. This was the impact of the psychological, that they were going to reinstate the rule, and we can take credit for that. But in the meantime, the markets are still unstable. What's really keeping the markets up these days is the fact that the Federal Reserve has been flooding the system with money precisely because the system is unstable.
So although you think it's going to dip down now?
If the Federal Reserve stops to do what they're doing, which is they surely will have to at some point, then the fact that the markets are unstable should show it. Which is not a... This is going to come back. It's not over yet. So I have here, I don't know, I just show you a couple of quick things. You see your patient. This is Twitter analysis. It lets us look at social systems. So we have geotagged tweets, and we looked at positive and negative sentiment, and we can see that people are happy in parks and unhappy in traffic jams and near sewage dumps and things like that. It's kind of cute. We can look at sort of the dynamics of people over the day. You know, they go to work, they go home, they go to stadia. You know, if there's a whole bunch of people in a stadium over the weekend, we can see how that the dynamics of that. So this is red is positive relative to mean, and blue is negative relative to mean. It's just a way of showing it. And we can do this globally, which is kind of fun too. Anyway, this is just Twitter activity globally. You can see how people go to sleep as the nighttime is over. Anyway, and this is a study of social networks. So this is just, in brief, we took people that tweeted New York Times articles and we pulled together the ones that are following each other and pushed apart the other ones. And so the structure of this network is just because of who's following whom, and the colors are about the subjects that they're tweeting. And you can basically, the result is you can learn that people who care about global things, they talk to people who care about global things. People who care about New York talk to people who care about New York talk to people who care about New York. And these are sort of nationally interested people, and they're polarized liberal, conservative, and people who care about business, sports, and art. So this is a way to understand how society is organized, which is quite interesting. All right, so let me do Ebola. So this is actually an outgrowth of some really fundamental physics stuff applied to biology. So this is a model of hosts and pathogens where the pathogens are evolving. Okay? So the red changed color. Now notice there's a bright red one that's more aggressive. It's spreading more rapidly in this case. And it dies out. Can you tell me why it would die out, the more aggressive one, either more lethal or more rapidly spreading, or both? It kills off the host locally. Exactly right. So it turns out that this is really fundamental importance in biology, because in biology, something that reproduces more rapidly, something that reproduces more rapidly should dominate the population. So to make a long story short, this is really about, was originally for us about studying a basic biology and bringing, you know, the breakdown of mean field theory. Again, you're not in condensed matter, so you don't know, but the whole point of this argument is translates into breakdown of averaging. So the breakdown of averaging in a magnet is exactly translated here into breakdown of certain fundamental ideas in evolution. And we were studying that. But so here's another picture of this. There's this different color scheme, doesn't matter. This is a bright blue one that's more aggressive. It leaves a hole and then goes extinct. So what happens if we add long-range transportation to this picture? So here's the short story, right? So we have this kind of predator or pathogen. If we add long-range link, they become more aggressive. Why do they become more aggressive? Because they escape the local extinction and go somewhere else. If we add more long-range link, you get even more aggressive varieties and a few more, and you not only get more aggressive varieties, but actually the whole thing goes extinct. So this is what we call the phase transition to extinction. So this is unit probability of survival over long term. This is zero probability of survival over long term. And we have a very sharp transition. So does this sound good? No. And basically what this says is that someone could add some more plane route somewhere and you wouldn't know and we'd be past this. You know, you could be, in principle, things look normal over here. I mean, the dynamics we're not talking about, right? But survival, long-term survival is fine, and you go past this boundary and all of a sudden everything's extinct, yes?
So that model also says that you have long-term travel regardless if there's an outbreak and stuff.
Correct.
So if stuff is going critical, people are still flying.
Correct.
So the model's level.
Correct. So that's exactly right. But this points to either the idea that you better restrict travel or you better restrict travel dynamically, if you can, fast enough. But if you think about it for a moment, and this gets to something, you know, that we'll talk about with Ebola, if things are rapidly spreading enough, you don't have the time to react dynamically also. So we made this, by the way, is work that we published 8 years ago. It's work that we did 10 years ago. And we created this simulation of, guess what, Ebola spreading around the world. We basically started with an infection in the area where Ebola used to be and said, what happens if it spreads? I mean, Again, this is a toy simulation. This is just for communication purposes. We did the same thing from Asia, right? Because there were a bunch of, you know, pandemics that started in Asia. This is just for aura, right? I mean, this is for understanding what things look like. And then we did one from New York City just for the fun of it. Why not? Okay, we stopped it when we punched out all the cities. Now, I've been talking about this for about 10 years. And audiences in general say, uh-oh, we're in trouble, but no one does anything about it. So I was in January, I was at the World Health Organization, and I gave a talk, and this was part of my talk. And their jaws dropped appropriately, and they were very impressed. There was a lot of positive response. But of course, what do you do? And the answer is, there's a real fundamental problem with the way things have been done. And if you read articles today, you say maybe they're changing. But the point is that fundamentally, we're vulnerable through increasing travel. And historically, up until this year, everybody's been focused on just the disease that we have now, the conditions, the, you know, whatever is the current, you know, specific. So they do simulations. You know, there are people that have a lot of funding to do simulations of disease spread. But what do they study? They study the diseases that we have. And they don't study changing conditions and changing disease properties, which is not a reasonable thing. There's one other point, and this goes back to policymakers. Matteo asked me, he says, why didn't people at the beginning of the Ebola epidemic realize that they needed to cut down on travel, protect against spreading globally? So you have to think, you have to really understand how physicians are trained. What does a physician do? Physician, when a patient shows up in the physician's office, the physician evaluates the patient and prescribes a treatment, provides care. What's missing from that? Any kind of dynamics, any kind of network understanding, and any kind of social structure. It's just not present in the room. Now, when they do study transmission, they study it in a mean field, right? Averaging approximation. So they assume that there is an average transmissibility, basically, which is called R-naught. And everything is about this R-naught. But remember what I talked about, tail events? So in diseases where you have a network, a social network, you can have one person that has a very large transmission event, you know, infecting 100 people, say, even if the average is only 2 or 3. If you had a normal distribution, that wouldn't be true. So these people are living in a normal distribution world and just don't understand that there are risks that they're taking that are not reasonable. So if you have a normal distribution, you have 2 transmissions per event, then, well, someone comes from here, from Africa, so you have a few cases and you can manage it. It's not a public health risk. And that's basically what they will say. If, on the other hand, you had 20 people, then the contact tracing method that they use breaks down, and the whole approach to intervention socially has to change. So what they do, just to remind you, if you haven't been reading about this, is when a patient shows up in the hospital or in the doctor's office, so to speak, what they do is they treat the patient, and they do one more thing. They ask who are the people you've been in touch with recently, and they try to find them and monitor them or isolate them or whatever is appropriate in order to prevent further transmission. If you have more than a few people in a place like this, which is Freetown in Sierra Leone, that just doesn't work. There's no way. And so this is what happened in Sierra Leone. It's still happening now. It's still, as far as we know today, the data is consistent with exponential growth. Hopefully they'll get it under control. Now, when I realized that there was need for intervention, us getting involved, I have contacts at the CDC because I've worked with the CDC. I have contacts with the UN. Because of the food issues that we've been dealing with. So I called up the people and I said, we have this problem that we're not responding well enough globally. And they were very receptive. But it's very clear that they didn't understand how to change their intervention strategies. So I came up with an intervention strategy which is based upon an understanding which is multi-scale. Right? How do you do it? You can't only do individual level. You have to do community level, national level, international level. The key part of it is actually the community level. So instead of trying to trace contacts of a person, you really just, you say the community could be infected, anybody. So what you do is you have to track the community. So the approach was to send a team of people to a local neighborhood to screen all of the people. If you catch the early symptoms, then you stop the transmission. You basically stop it dead in its tracks. You have to bring them food because you don't want them to be traveling around, but basically that's the idea. That was the idea that I presented. And it got distributed around, and we could talk to people. Eventually, I called the people in Liberia and spoke to people on the ground. And it turns out that they'd already started doing this 2 weeks earlier. They did it better than my suggestion, which is that they sent people door to door in a neighborhood, the people who know the people in the neighborhood. So they took neighborhood people, and they organized them to go door to door and do screening. This is what happened in Liberia. So now there were four things. To be fair, there were four things that happened at about the same time. I have to remember what they all are. But one of them was the door-to-door screening. The other one was the fact that the communities began to take it seriously. So they probably, you know, they did more hand washing. They did more, you know, social distancing, it's called, right, where they avoid contact with each other. There was more international response, and they began to build additional facilities. But the medical authorities were sitting in the hospitals out here, okay, and even further, saying, we don't see people showing up in the hospitals. We don't know why. Maybe people are hiding them. But they're not showing up in the hospital. We have empty hospital beds. So they were standing in the hospitals. They weren't standing in the communities aware of what was going on in the community. And this is a dramatic decrease. And this, by the way, Liberia has just declared that they're going to try to be Ebola-free before Christmas. Pretty impressive. So I can't make any claims for this. They did it themselves. But this is, as far as I'm concerned, validation of our claim. It's validation on two fronts. Number one, that the public health authorities don't have a clue. And number two, the community-based interventions work. I already talked about a little bit about risk in the US and other places. And my basic statement is there's unreasonable risks that are being taken. If there's a risk of 1 in 3 that there would be a major outbreak, or 1 in 10 or 1 in 100, it's a crazy risk. And I do think that the risk is much higher than the public health authorities are acknowledging. So that's it. This was the presentation, and I know that we've done a lot. But I talked about this, I talked about this, I talked about this and this. I didn't talk about this. There's a whole bunch of other work that we've done on the economic crisis, about panic on markets, about how dependencies in the economy work. About the European bond crisis, and so on. There's a lot of work that we've done on ethnic violence and social unrest beyond what I've talked about here. So we've done a fair amount of different things. And again, just going back to sort of the basic idea, it's always kind of amazing. What we do is we come up with the right mathematical model or the right understanding, and we plug it in, and we say, here it is. And of course, everyone is there saying, oh, somehow you figured that, you guessed right. You cannot guess in these contexts. You have to have a reason for coming up with a model. And because we have the fundamental understanding from physics, we can. And that's really what matters. Thank you.